Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. In the House of History, there are many rooms. Over the next several months, we'll occasionally be talking to someone about the state of their various sub-discipline in history. To kick things off today, we have my colleague Brian Leach here in the Department of History at Augustana College to talk about environmental history. You've heard him before speaking about the Big Pit, the mine, the hole that ate Butte, Montana. Now he'll explain his own sub-discipline, environmental history. So, Brian, you in the sort of notes that you've given me, you discussed that environmental history came from three original other sort of sub-areas of history. And it's kind of ironic, I have to say at the outset, that you're going first with environmental history. This will probably be broadcast to Earth Day, so that gets its bonus points with the Green God.
Perfect.
Because this is almost the most recent type of history, but it's been extremely prolific. But where did it come from originally?
Well, I think it has lots of various pathways in, and thanks again, Al, for having me on again. There are, of course, a number of different origins, everything from Frederick Jackson Turner in 1893 talking about the frontier to what had been geography, right? Historical geography.
Right.
Had been doing a lot of work that was essentially environmental history before there was environmental history. But these elements came together, I'd say, again, really recently. And so you're right. I mean, it's not really till the 1970s and really the 1980s that you can identify a lot of works that seem to be something like environmental history.
So in many ways, what was the old line, which is not true, I think at the Johns Hopkins seminar room, was history is past politics. In many ways, environmental history was present politics in the 70s and 80s,
yes.
And that influenced what people were doing in their study.
Very true. So just like all of the various kind of sub-disciplines of social history, right, that emerge in the 60s and 70s, you know,
yeah.
Where you've got, you know, various people studying, you know, race and gender, and, you know, there are kind of emerging out of those political movements. Certainly environmental history emerges out of the environmental movement. And that's why, you know, when I was kind of making this outline of these kind of three original areas, the first area that you'd probably identify as being environmental history were people who were working on the history of environmental politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or in that case, in most cases, they were talking about it as conservation, right?
Right.
Conservation politics. And
so they're studying Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot.
That's right.
And then water conservation, water aqueducts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I think the work I picked out to maybe best represent that is Samuel Hayes' Conservation and the Gospel of Efficiency, which was a book from 1959, so all the way back then.
Oh my gosh!
And you know, there's one. I mean, the argument's kind of in the title there, right?
Mm-hmm.
The
yeah.
Efficiency is conservation, right? And so there's kind of that branch, right, that was very heavily political. And so a lot of the first works, right, in the 70s and 80s were kind of just tracing environmental politics, right? What groups became, I guess you could say, conscious of the environment in some way and started making claims based on nature or saving something about nature.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly kind of that's a strand. The other two I was identifying on this list is, in some ways, it's one of the main reasons that environmental history emerges in some ways in the 70s comes out of work like Donald Worster that was doing, and I think his most famous book, Dust Bowl, I noted here. And what Donald Worster was doing and a lot of others is they were trying to essentially bring the material, right,
uh-huh.
And in a non-Marxist sense, right, but uh-huh. do material history, and i.e. looking at nature and looking at the environment and seeing how humans had changed it, right?
So,
what had they done?
So by material history, you mean what?
I mean these kind of base things, these natural resources
okay.
that are at the core of driving a lot of historical change, right? So, people needing them, using them.
So the, and in fact, there's a recent sort of popular genre of these books, like,
yes.
I forget his name, Cod.
Yeah, Kurslansky. Yeah, yeah,
Mark Kurslansky. Or yeah, something right, like
right.
that.
Right.
Basically commodities, materials, right. things like that.
Right,
this is
right.
material history.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, a lot of it kind of was commodities, and certainly the way Worcester did a lot of his early work, and a lot of the people who followed him, right, this is very... I guess what we as historians would now call declensionist, in the sense that it was all about decline, right?
Right.
It was about people showing up and ruining everything. And in a lot of ways, these were based on how capitalism often was the way this was framed, right? Capitalism had changed the way that we related to nature, and that nature became a commodity, a profit,
right.
Making mechanism as opposed to something.
Or monotheism. I'm thinking of the famous, was it Hayden White?
Mm-hmm.
Essay from 68-69
mm-hmm.
about how Christianity, Judaism had ruined Islam.
Right.
The whole had ruined right. pastoral,
right.
A lovely, Arcadia.
Yeah, similar kinds of arguments. Yeah.
And then there's cultural history, which is kind of funny because that's almost, is just barely before, in many ways, as a defined subfield of history. It's just barely birthed before environmental
right,
history.
Right, right. And there are some people who are doing kinds of cultural work. I mean, a lot of it's, I guess, what we might call older cultural history, in the sense it was mostly looking at literature and art. And, you know, I think that the work that I picked out that maybe represents that best would be something like Leo Marx's The Machine and the Garden.
Which is a fantastic book.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And we'll have links, we'll have a list of these books up on the website.
Yeah. And there's, you know, but it's slower to get going, if you want the truth, in terms of history, right? Because in some ways, right, environmental history emerges because people say, hey, you know, nature matters. We need to be talking more mm-hmm. about nature and its relationship to people. And so it's much slower to get going in terms of people talking about, you know, what's the idea of nature? What's the idea of wilderness? All mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Although once that hits, right, which is really starting in the 90s mostly, right. then in some ways begins to dominate a lot of the field.
So, I mean, let me see if I get this right. Up until that moment, we accept a very vague definition of what nature is, or what environment is, or what wilderness is.
Right, right.
And then in the 90s, people realize, wait a second. This actually, what is wilderness? That conceptions of wilderness change.
Right.
So explain that a little bit.
Well, I think the best representative of that, that genre of kind of troubling what nature is and what it means, is William Cronin's actually rather famous article in some circles, beloved in other circles, reviled article that was called The Trouble with Wilderness, or Getting Back to the Wrong Nature, I believe is the subtitle to it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, part of what he's arguing here is that wilderness is not a thing that ever really existed in the U.S., right?
Right.
So he's saying, you know, in some ways, right, all these people who politically were moving towards saving wilderness areas because no one had ever been there, that these wilderness areas, right, it had been inhabited and changed by people for millennia, right? And so he was trying to show in that article that the concept of wilderness was something, right, that had been created in some ways it ends up being a justification for a lot of these political actions. And he says, well, you know, yes, except, you know, and yes, some of this land is great to save for all these other reasons, but mm-hmm. we aren't really saving it because it's never been touched or never been used. There's no such thing as wilderness to some extent.
Which is kind of funny because in his famous book, Changes in the Land,
right,
he might have suggested that at least there was something of a wilderness that mm-hmm. Europeans had kind of ruined in New England.
Right.
But as subsequent study, I mean, let's talk about fire and Indians. You want to talk about fire and Indians?
Sure.
Because that's one of my favorite
sure.
subjects.
Yeah.
I mean, up until, I'd say the 90s, maybe, well, we've known that Indians burned large swaths of woodland
right.
in order to hunt.
Yes.
Yet that was denied. Sometimes that was denied. Why?
Well, it's there's a lot of good reasons to deny it if, for instance, you want to pretend that Indians had been doing nothing with the land, right? And
right.
so in some ways, it's a really good justification for you showing up and improving it, right, mm-hmm. as a Euro-American.
Right. That's the earliest reason.
Yeah, that's... and that's
except that the Euro-Americans also watched them do it or had seen it.
Right.
You know, you see some Virginian, or they
right.
knew that it was
right.
going on around them.
Right.
So the second reason was, I think, to preserve an idea of basically repristinate the wilderness.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, I agree.
Because there was an idea in some sense that the Indians, and this is a very 70s idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Indian with the tear going down his face, right?
Yes,
the Indians lived in such tune with nature that they didn't need to harm it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, there's a great book by Shepard Kretsch, which is it's called The Ecological Indian. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So in some ways, right, he takes the idea of, you know, this ecologically sustainable American Indian, and you know, he's like, well, it's not like they weren't using the land and reshaping it in all sorts of ways, whether it's building roads or mounds or
growing
crops, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of people in the U.S. who still don't understand that there was lots of agriculture going on by Indians, right? They think that they're all running around on the prairie shooting buffalo,
right? And of course they were working, as it were, with nature.
Right.
Nature wants to burn in some way. Marshes want to burn. Woodlands want to burn. It's only in wilderness management techniques of the National Forest Service wildernesses don't burn in those techniques.
Yes.
But this is all an argument over wilderness.
Right, it is. It is very much so. And you know, I think that when that change happens, when people start kind of, you know, I don't know what terminology I want to use, but really kind of making a complex look at what nature means, what wilderness means, then all of a sudden the subject of their study becomes, again, more complex.
Yeah.
In some ways, harder to identify and figure out what it is, but also really sophisticated, I think, a lot of other ways, right? Because it's not just Europeans show up and ruin land, right? All of a sudden it's, what did Europeans think was the environment or was nature? And what did Indians think that was? And how were those things different? And that leads to a really much more interesting story, honestly, than just people showing up and ruining things.
Yeah, it gets interesting and complex. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like as messy as everyday life. Paul Sutter,
an
article in the Journal of American History.
Yes.
Is talking, and that was in 2013.
Yes.
I read before we got together to record this. He's discussing, basically he refers to this idea of hybrid landscapes.
Right.
Is this where the conversation went after the wilderness controversy?
Yes, very, very much.
So what's a hybrid landscape?
Yeah. A hybrid landscape, I think my best example is a book by Mark Fiji, which is called Irrigated Eden, and it's looking at the Snake River Valley in Idaho, and I've sometimes used this in class because I think it's a really great example of a hybrid landscape and what that means. He starts off that book by describing him kind of rolling up to a section of irrigation, right? I believe it's in Idaho in this case, right? And he goes down and he just kind of describes himself kneeling down and looking along, right, the pathway, right, where it's getting irrigated, and it's a man-made feature, and yet on the other hand, there's all this wildlife, right, growing there, kind of reshaping it, changing it itself, and you know, he starts kind of calling this a hybrid landscape, right? It's not completely changed and remade by man, but on the other hand, it's also certainly not a quote-unquote natural or pristine natural landscape, and I you know, a lot of work. Certainly since then, but even a little bit before, I mean, you could point to Richard White's book, The Organic Machine, right? Which again has those two elements, right? Where you've got organic, right? The nature, and you've got machine, the kind of cultural human construct, and that these things are really kind of melded and meshed together. And so a lot of the work since then in environmental history has been trying to break down this nature culture divide, right? Mm-hmm. That people and, that, you know, that people have been changing constantly the natural environment. The natural environment's been kind of constantly changing how people live and what they do and what they need and all that.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that's, of course, it's an important realization that the line between sort of nature and culture goes through basically a barnyard in many ways. And anyone who's seen a dandelion spring up through a pavement understands what, you know, he was seeing in that irrigation ditch.
Yeah.
So this gets us into a really interesting question that Sutter asks, and that is one of causation and agency. What do we mean when we talk about agency in historical thinking or historical studies?
Yeah, well, I mean, agency, of course, is very important to historians in the sense that we're very interested in letting our subjects be able to act and have an ability to act, right?
Right.
If they don't have an ability to act, therefore they're not a a true person. So in other words, as opposed to seeing history completely from a top-down sort of way where you have people imposing things on other people who have to just kind of follow along, right? Here you can have every single group in society having a consciousness of themselves either as a group or as a single person and have the agency, i.e. the ability to kind of change their own situation.
Right. So, and hence we speak of enslaved people rather than slaves.
Yes.
Since even people who are enslaved still have agency.
Yeah, right.
They can, ultimately they can free themselves. They can run away.
And there's a great environmental history of slavery that in some ways is about, right, people who are enslaved who have the ability to use their natural landscape, right?
Yeah.
I think it's, isn't it the, if you're looking at like the coastal Carolinas, they will, go along the pathways outside of the rice plantation because they know it better than the masters, so they can just kind of escape for a little bit. Yeah. They can hunt. They can do all sorts of
things. Yeah, that's there's a good book written by a... a lay historian, a lawyer in North Carolina, but a brilliant book called The Waterman's Song, which is looking at basically saltwater slavery.
Sure.
Or those people in the low country of North Carolina who in the sort of because their interface between land and sea, they had certain greater freedoms. They might allowed to go off and fish for 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah.
As part of as a commercial fisherman.
Yeah.
They were still enslaved.
Right.
But that gave them that environment gave them.
Yeah.
The nature of the environment gave them greater latitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the interesting part here is that, a lot of historians' project in many cases, right, is to help, give these people the agency that they have in their daily lives.
Yeah.
And the strange part about environmental history, right, is that a lot of people who are environmental historians is they want to give nature agency, right? and part of what Sutter's getting at there that's somewhat troubling is that, what does it mean for nature to have agency, right? Nature acts in a situation and it changes things, but it'll often, right, if you're looking at nature writ large, right, does a forest have an attitude? Does it have an outlook? Right. Can it act? Well, yes and no, right?
And I reckon also part of this is the feeling from the environmental movement that much of human agency has been detrimental to the environment.
Right.
So they're ambivalent about the idea of human agency.
Yes.
Okay. So we have that discussion. What are we anywhere beyond... this idea of anywhere beyond hybrid landscapes, anywhere beyond this question of agency, has there been a consensus yet? A consensus history?
Certainly not. I don't know if there's been a beyond. I think actually one of the best things I think I've seen that's happened in environmental history is there's been a lot of people who, as a way to give nature agency, they've broken it up into constituent parts so that they can talk about, these single beings and how these other beings who are not people, right, interact and change situations, right? So, all these, new studies fields in just the last few years, animal studies, right, food studies, some ways a lot of these groups, right, people doing food history, doing animal history are doing that work in really interesting ways, but because they're able to focus just on what happens with the pig, right, they're able to say a pretty interesting story. You could say that certainly there's a kind of a long tradition of water history, right? Mm-hmm. Or oceans, right? If you're looking at a bigger body of water, a fairly big book, I think it was the year before, Jeffrey Bolster's The Mortal Sea, which in some ways is kind of an environmental history because he's looking at, a 500-year decline of fisheries, right, over that case by looking at the sea. And so...
And John Gillis's The Human Shore.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get him on the podcast. That's about the, once again, the people's predilection to at first not live and now live next to the ocean.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think actually in some ways breaking those elements down has been useful to environmental historians so that they can talk about, what's the agency of, right, of a rat running through New York City, right, of pests and how people have to deal with pests and what pests and how they think about them, or weeds, right? How do we define weeds? What do weeds do for us? How does a weed act, right, and, ruin our farm or our garden or whatever it is? And so I think there's some really good ways to look past this kind of difficulty of what does nature mean with agency by doing that work.
And yet it seems to me very helpful to study the thing that man can't control and has no agency against. If I'm writing a history of man and hurricanes, I mean, it's great to talk about agency and stuff, but the fact is the hurricane still comes. the hurricane comes.
Yes, it does.
And it will kill you.
Yes. And I think, you know, especially, you know, there's a lot of great environmental history being written about natural disasters.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think it's really important to our modern understanding of current problems, right? Because we have to deal with so many natural disasters, and there's so much, right, that people don't and can't and will never be able to control about nature, that in some ways it might teach us to both live with that and figure out ways that we can cope and live with those situations.
To cope with the fact that we've thought of that for the last 50,000 years, with a brief exception, maybe in the last 100, I don't know.
Right.
That we, maybe less, a lot less.
Right, right.
In your notes, you refer to lots and lots and lots of sub areas of environmental history. And Sutter, in his article, refers to this. It's just crazy the way in which environmental history has spun into all these different bifurcated sections. If there's certainly, it's the moment for it to do that. It's been very fertile in doing that. But let's go. Let's try to walk through some of them. Maybe we'll get through big history, seems to me, which is the latest, least popular thing.
Yeah, sure.
Bill Gates gives us a lot of money. that seems to me also a spinoff of this.
But, yeah.
The environmental management state. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, part of what Sutter's getting at here is that there's been a lot of, I think, really important work, especially in the 90s and the 2000s, about ways that the state, whether it's, you know, federal, local system, you know, whoever is in charge in the government, has been operating and changing the environment or changing ways that can kind of interrelate with the environment. And certainly some of this has actually been important for people, you know, combining social history with environmental history. And so something like Louis Warren's The Hunter's Game or Carl Jacobi's Crimes Against Nature, part of what they're doing there is they're saying, you know, conservationists come in and they say, we need to conserve. And yet that certainly benefits, for instance, sports hunters often, right? And it will hurt people who are doing subsistence hunting or subsistence gathering of firewood, or in a lot of cases, Native Americans get hurt by a lot of these situations, right? You form a national park, you say, look, here's a place that was that's pristine nature we're saving. By the way, could the tribe please get off the land, right? And so there's been a lot of really good history written in those ways, right? Talking about the state.
You agro-environmental history.
Yeah. This has been actually a really long-standing field in the sense that there's always been a lot of rural history and a lot of agricultural history.
Yeah.
But I think since environmental history has kind of taken on this subject, there's been even more great work. The example I pulled out on the notes here that I like quite a bit, Judith Carney's Black Rice, which triggered this big debate, right?
Yeah,
over over whether or not, you know, there were African origins to rice cultivation and how rice cultivation happened in the Americas.
How did rice get to the Americas? It turned out no one had really thought much about that. And then it, they had told some stories that didn't really bear up under scrutiny.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this has been fascinating because in some ways, right, if you think it has an African origin, right, it ruins the perception of, you know, these Euro-Americans coming in and forcing people to do things their way and their style. But there's other kind of agro-environmental history that has been kind of a little bit broader in scope and gone globally and looked at, you know, those commodities across the world, right? So John Slurry's banana cultures, right, that looks at, you know, what happens, how do you get bananas to the U.S., why does that happen, you know, how do they get sold?
I mean, Judith Carney was getting to like a lot of this, was getting... A lot of these history is connected to everything else. Every sub-history is connected to everything else.
Yep.
When by doing that in agro-environmental history, what she got to, which I know better, slavery. And she was discussing the nature of slavery and how it might be different than we think it is.
Yeah, I think a lot of what this work is that we're kind of going over is some ways that environmental history has started to stand out, I think, to a lot of other historians, because we're able to suddenly shed an entirely brand new light on a lot of situations that people have been discussing and debating for a long time, but had maybe not considered a new way of seeing it.
Just finally read Jack Kirby's, was it Jack Temple Kirby?
Yeah.
The Mockingbird song.
Oh, sure.
About Southern the environmental history of the South.
Yeah.
And so that's talking about Appalachia and in very new ways.
Yeah.
That way. The history of medicine and actually history of disease has been around for decades.
Right.
But there is now an environmental, now we can do an environmental history of disease and health. What does that mean?
Well, I think this is actually one of my favorite new, I don't know, subgenres. In fact, I guess it's been a year ago now in the spring, I taught a course on kind of health and the environment because there's been so much great work. And a lot of what they're trying to do in a lot of these works, right, is show how interconnected bodily health, right, which again, we've been studying as, you know, the history of medicine and a lot of these areas, right, is often connected to environmental health. And certainly both conceptually and, you know, in very literal terms, right? When you're looking at something like, there's this great book that Greg Mittman wrote called Breathing Space, right, that's about allergies.
Yeah.
You know, and so he takes the idea that we would have allergies because we suddenly have a much more pristine urban environment that people are trying to live in. And all of a sudden what you're seeing instead is you have a pristine environment. So now when you encounter pollens or something like that, right, you have reactions. And so he has this great history where then people retreat to the wilderness, right, to get better, right? And you get the wilderness
Phoenix.
Cure. And, yep, and that's the classic.
And they bring their plants with them.
They often do. Right. But I mean, like how many, you know, for how long, I don't even know, had the people been, you know, the prescription was move to the Southwest. Right. Right? I mean, this happened to my grandparents. Yeah. Right. That was
I think, isn't that what D.H. Lawrence ended up in Taos, New Mexico? I think,
yes.
For that reason.
Right.
Lots of people did.
Right.
Or like Walker Percy ended up getting TB and going to meeting his wife in Lake Saranac, I think it was, a TB asylum. That was sort of the same sort of idea.
Yeah, sure.
Go to pristine, healthy place.
Right. Breathe the clean mountain air,
air, which might be bad or good for you. I forget which.
Yeah.
The human-built world. Well, this is your thing. This is what your dissertation's about. Mining, industrial world.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and some of this is, you know, going to an urban place and seeing nature in there, or looking at the ways that industry has shaped nature, or nature has, you know, forced industry to kind of rethink how it goes about things. So everything from, obviously I do a lot of mining history, and, one of my favorite books, right, is Thomas Andrews, Killing for Coal, which, you know, it starts with the Ludlow Massacre, in which you have, the National Guard come in and essentially, really slaughter a number of labor protesters. And yet, instead of just telling that story again, which has been told lots of times, he instead says, hey, you know, this is also in the middle of a big transition across the West, from shifting from organic fuel sources to fossil fuels. And what does that mean? He even has this great term that I have reappropriated called a workscape, right? Where it's a landscape that is also kind of a factory, like a workplace and a landscape. And that, you know, I think it's actually a really great way to describe a mine.
It is.
And so, you know, I think, again, it's a very hybrid landscape kind of book, but he shows how, for instance, the dangers of that workscape makes miners bond together better, and that therefore they're more willing to protest when the company comes through and forces them to do other actions. So I think it's a fascinating book in the sense that it's doing so much, right? It gives nature agency, it gives people agency, all the different people in the story get agency, and it fits it in kind of a broader big time frame of these major changes coming across the world and the U.S.
Some you make note of that there are some areas that Sutter in his review essay doesn't touch. One of them is, there's an interesting connection, of course, and it's sort of, given what we've already discussed, it's not that surprising, between Native American history and environmental history. We've got Cronin's essay Become a Book, Changes in the Land. We've got Richard White as well. What, though, is deep history?
in some ways, this, you know, this emerges from a lot of different areas. Although, you were just in my class the other day talking about the Annales, school of history, right? The idea being that yes, there's lots of these kind of short, quick, changes in history, and yet there's much big, broader trends happening in any case. And in some ways, environmental history is really set up to do that very well, right? Because it's not going to just look at this one moment of time in history, but, you know, you could look in the past. You could even look before a group of people were in an area, and you could start with that past and then lead it into the present. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of work that's been done in environmental history, especially when they're taking almost any spot in, for instance, North America, because they're looking in that broader time frame, will start in an area and talk about, you know, its past in terms of Native Americans, how they're affecting the land, dealing with the land, and then make it its way all the way up to Europeans and what Europeans are doing. My favorite examples may be like Elliot West, who has this great book, The Contested Plains, mm-hmm. Which is about the gold rush to Colorado, right? It's not actually about the gold rush in Colorado. It's about the gold rush to Colorado. So it's about the plains.
So it's how the environment of the plains was changed because of the gold rush to Colorado.
Right. And I'd say in some ways vice versa, right? How the environment was changing them, right? As they were trying, you know, so how it was forcing them to do one thing over another, or, you know, there's even sections here where, you know, it's hard for settlers to make it across because, there'll be like Indians upset, right? Because settlers will have shown up with their oxen and horses and eaten all the grass. And so the Indians will come by, right? And in some ways, you know, this is actually ends up being really troubling for a lot of the Indians, who then can't subsist on the plains in the ways that they had been doing before, because all of a sudden all of their fuel sources for their, you know, horses and their other animals are completely gone, right? So it's an unlivable landscape suddenly. So I think there's all sorts of really interesting things that
tells you about the number of horses and oxen that were traveling.
Yeah,
in order to
definitely,
my gosh.
Yeah.
One thing related to this, you have a book, Andrew Eisenberg's Destruction of the Bison, which is a great book.
Mm-hmm.
I guess even in sort of the big history, in the prehistory stuff, is what happened to the large mammal population after the arrival of the Paleo-Indian. Is that a subject of study right now?
Yeah, it is, and I think rather controversial too.
Rather controversial. That's why I brought it up.
Yeah, the great Pleistocene extinction, right? And so all these large animals die off during that period, and there's been a hypothesis that this was because, you know, the group of people we now call Native Americans, had shown up and had killed off a lot of these animals,
and for which I'm somewhat thankful. Actually, because I figure the saber-toothed tiger and me, those are big animals. So
yes.
Maybe that was not such a body.
Yes. But
it's,
I mean,
it's sad to lose any animal from the earth. But, you know, there are some exceptions.
But, I mean, a lot of the other claims about that, right, are that the climate had changed, and therefore that's why the animals had died off. And, in fact, that's been as we all spend all this time talking about climate change today and in modern politics, so that's been an emerging little subgenre of environmental history too, and obviously with increasing importance, where people are doing climate history, right? Yeah. They're showing how the climate change had affected people in the past, what kinds of climate change.
That was, I mean, back in when I was doing medieval history, which was a long time ago, certainly discussing climate was a big, big deal for us. And that was, I mean, I hesitate to say, that was almost before global warming controversies.
Right.
Back then we took it for granted. Yeah. There was a medieval warm period and stuff like that.
Right,
and
right.
And it changed remarkably the culture and politics and blah, blah, blah of medieval Europe, as had the sort of the Maunder Minimum or the cold period of the 17th and 18th century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting to see, there's been a lot of new work, new articles coming out that are essentially climate, right? You know, the most recent environmental history journal that I received has this article by a Yale historian, Alan Michael, that's about this Icelandic volcano eruption and how that affects the Ottoman Empire all the way over there, right? And so I think, again, I think an interesting way to view history, again, in some ways, right, a lot of these are not brand new trends, right? But now that they're kind of enveloped in an umbrella of environmental history, in some ways it helps them be able to talk to each other.
One, and we've got Jeffrey Parker, who's a very eminent military historian, just wrote the book Global Catastrophe about what he sees as the worldwide catastrophe of climate change in the mid-17th century, and trying to link it to, well, does link it to the 30 Years' War, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, yeah.
We've got about, we're running out of time, got about 5 or 6 minutes left. So let's talk about some of these, the ways in which environmental history has recently changed. Do you mean like the last 2 years, or is that a, is that a shorter event?
Oh, maybe 5, 10 years.
You actually did mention climate change. What about natural disaster?
Well, I think there's been some great work. Ted Steinberg has this great book, Acts of God, right, that's showing how a lot of these things that we talk about as natural disasters have a lot of unnatural elements to them, i.e. that people are causing or in some cases not causing the natural disaster, but making it worse, right, by a lot of the things that they've done. Obviously, an event like Hurricane Katrina can convince you of some of those kinds of ideas. And so he's kind of tracing that back in the past. There's a brand new book called The Lost History of the New Madrid Earthquakes that I just started reading.
I want to read that book.
A couple days ago.
As soon as you're done with that, I'm fascinated by the new Madrid.
Madrid, you're correct. Yes, thank you.
Your Missourian pronunciation.
Yes.
The New Madrid Earthquake, that's
right.
That's,
you know, so I mean, it's a series of, I think it's four earthquakes in 1811, 1812 that, it happens in Missouri, right? Or Missouri, right?
Missouri.
It's this kind of middle Mississippi Valley. Yeah.
Fortunately, and not even natives want to live in that area where that happened.
Right.
Which is now they.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's the fascinating part about it, right? Is how it. I mean, it had this all these dramatic effects.
Church bells in New England actually did ring due to the tremors.
Oh wow.
Yeah, that's one story I've heard. And we know that Mississippi did reverse course in some places because of the.
Well, supposedly had it was felt for a much further distance than anything that has happened in California.
Anything. Yep.
And part of it is because I guess the kind of earthquake it was, right? I'm trying to think what the name of that type. Anyways,
it's the geology of.
Because it's it actually ends up, I think, shaking the ground more than rippling it, and so there was a lot of this dramatic shaking. So I mean, it had all these, the author makes the point, right, that this is Valencius. He makes the point that it kind of contributes to frontier religious revival, right? There's all these Native Americans who were affected, and so it changes a lot of the settlement patterns.
Tecumseh's Indian Indian revival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gives him credit for it.
A murder committed by Thomas Jefferson's nephews is shaken up from its hiding place, and they are then charged. That's another sort of side. I'm a little freaky interested in the new.
Yeah. This is such a good book because in some ways, right, it's kind of re-expressing a lot of these great stories related to that earthquake. But he's also trying to make the point that why is it that no one talks about it now? Well, people are starting to talk about it more with in the scientific community. And part of it is he's saying, well, there's all these different reasons why it's been forgotten. And one of the major reasons is because the way we talk about earthquakes now is in terms of plate tectonics, right? And because this is not at the edge of plates, people just stop talking about it, right?
So we're back to almost a Kuhnian exploration of history of science and the history of the profession of science.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of wonderful work being done in that little pathway there between history of science and environmental history, where a lot of people are doing, I think, important and really, really exciting work.
What's bioregional history?
Well, I guess I was thinking of this as another kind of major way that environmental history can contribute to the ways that everyone else does history, right? So there's been certainly a move in the last, 10, 15 years to do transnational history, global history, big history, right? All these things. In other words, getting kind of a broader both geographic and time scope. Yeah. And as I mentioned, right, I think environmental history is set up to do time very well. I think it's also set up to do geography in some different ways than a lot of other ways of looking at the world, right? Because it's not bound by political borders, right? If you have, industrial smoke spewing out on the edge of Canada, it's going to make its way into the US or vice versa. Or, you know, if you, you know, if you have an earthquake that starts one place, right, it's going to, you know, move across national borders. Mm-hmm. This idea of bioregional history, I mean, it kind of emerges out of geography. I have one of my favorite articles by Dan Flores, who makes kind of a case for bioregional history, where you might say, for instance, look at the Rocky Mountains, right? What's the history of the Rocky Mountains? Certainly the Rocky Mountains and what's happened in them and who lives there and why they live there has been shaped as much by the Rocky Mountains as by a lot of other trends. And so taking a look at bioregions might be a way to get past having to do history within borders, because, I mean, borders certainly matter a lot. On the other hand, sometimes they don't matter as much.
And in some ways, for a lot of different reasons, a lot of causations, bioregions might also match up with cultural patterns.
Right, yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Well, this has been fantastic. I hope everyone who listened to it enjoyed as much as I have in having the conversation. My guest today has been Brian Leach, my colleague in the Department of History at Augustana College. Brian, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.